Okay. I've read from a number of articles by Scott Nakagawa. Does the U.S. have a white people problem? I read from Dreamland, The Burning of Black Wall Street on the RogerEbert.com website, an article on NDN website about the termination period. But that's it for today. Thank you to my board operator, Ty, and thank you to all for listening. And those of you called in, this is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Stay tuned for more great programming here on KBOO. Bye-bye.
Hold your head up, lift the top of your mind, put your eyes on the earth, lift your heart to your own home planet. What do you see? What is your attitude?
You're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. The time is 8:59 a.m.
From Earth First, and when I'm in Portland, I listen to non-commercial community radio, KBOO Portland, no compromise in defense of the truth.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
Welcome to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. We feature interviews with leaders in the community, focusing on issues important to Washington County.
Welcome to Inside Washington County. I'm Rob Solomon. Today, we're going to look at racism, discuss what progress has been made over the past dynamic year, and consider just what lies ahead. Last December in 2020, my co-host for the program on racism that we did in our county assembled a great panel. Hector Hinosa, a longtime community activist in Hillsborough, has done it again. He is with us again today, and he has brought an excellent panel too. Thank you, Hector. Two of our original panel members are back. Hector will introduce today's panel.
Thank you, Rob. Before I do, I want to thank you and Mark for sharing your airspace, your microphone, your platform for us to share our voice to some of the important topic that we're going to discuss today. First, I'd like to start by welcoming back Dr. Waidi Saeed, the founder and president of the Muslim Educational Trust Center, and co-founder of Building Bridges, which I hope he can tell us a little bit about because it's such an important topic. Our Reverend Pastor Hennessy was not able to join us. Come back and join us. He's had a misfortune in his family, a death, and our condolences go out to him, and we'll miss him this session. However, we do have a wonderful replacement, a dear friend of mine and a community advocate. Dr. Coquelet is vice chair of the Oregon Democratic Party. Chair of the Democratic Statewide Black Caucus as well, and former Democratic Party here in Washington County, where I first met Rosa. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate it. And then we also have coming back is Dr. Louis Whitebear, who is the Associate Director over at the Longhouse and Oregon State University on campus and a new school board member. So welcome to all three of you. Glad to have you back. Rob, back over to you.
Thank you. Hector will assist in asking questions and also, as we said, add some of his own experiences to this very important discussion. Racism will not be eliminated in a day, a month, or a year. It will take time and it will take effort. The one thing we can't afford is to lose the momentum catalyzed by the tragic murder of George Floyd, among others. Racism will not go away if we don't face it directly and work to eliminate it. Thank you all for joining us today. Let's get started with our questions. Hector, if you'd ask the first one, that'd be great.
Great, thank you. The first question is, this past summer, following the Mr. Floyd's murder, called for change, where around the country and actually around the world, the protests were massive and lengthy. What did the movement for equity accomplish? And Dr. Rosa, let's start with you.
Thank you very much, Hector. And I'd also like to express my appreciation for sharing this platform with Dr. Louis and also Brother Waji and you and with Rob. In terms of what I think the greater accomplishments, I think there were many, but I think one of the greater accomplishments of the protests was simply a recognition that America essentially has reached the point of no return with respect to the killing of unarmed Black citizens by armed police. And I think that absent of the protest and absent of what we see in social media and in the press, I think that recognition would still be very much lagging. When one considers that there have been thousands of these traumatic killings or murders, more appropriately described, it's hard to imagine that the public, that the American public, and even outside of this country, is not fully and completely aware of these killings and these injustices. But yet, on many occasions, folks really are not. So I think that obviously there were some problems with some of the marches, but I think without them, there still would have been very much a lack of attention to and awareness of the extremity of the problem in terms of one thing that the marches may have accomplished.
Absolutely. One of the things that worried me, of course, is accepting, because I obviously the outcome and the being convicted is something that brings authenticates our legal system. So I'm proud and happy for that. But I'm concerned that folks will still have an issue in contrary to the findings. And so I'm hoping that reality doesn't get misplaced here. So, Dr. Waji, any comments on the subject?
I think, first of all, I would like to thank you, Hector and Rob, for inviting us again. And, and I'm very thankful that you invited Dr. Kulkait, another great beacon of light in our beloved community. And congratulations to Dr. White Bear for her election, as a school board member in the Corvallis community. My opinion is still the same, racism and all kind of bigotry need to be addressed from the grassroots level, looking at the history and how can we repair that history. Again, I always say that we men are the reason for all these disasters that we have seen, not the beloved women, because beloved women are healers and unifiers, most of the time, with the exception of Margaret Thatcher and people like her, But in generally speaking, I think the grassroots means that, I was honored and in my individual capacity to support campaigns, that brought sisters, to the board of directors of different school districts. And I think the sisters, we will see magnificent work you know, with the leadership in the school districts, to be able to address this racism and bigotry and equity and inclusion. And the inflections, you know, of racism, you know, and the outcomes of it's really deep rooted in the character building inside the house, inside the school, and then inside the community. And we cannot really forget the house. We cannot forget also the community, the schools, you know, and then the community as well. So bigotry has to be condemned, you know, in every single corner of our public square and private square as well. So yes, the verdict on George Floyd, you know, has served, you know, the justice in that context. But, you know, racism and bigotry is still deep rooted in our human family worldwide, and especially in a country like ours that's supposed to champion justice and inclusion. And unless, you know, the Native American and the African American gets the full, you know, compensation and the reparation, I don't think so we are going to heal in a holistic way. So we should really address, you know, the root of our national racism, and as well as the state racism, you know, through the context of the indigenous people, as well as, you know, the African American that brought, you know, in slavery. So reparation is one step towards healing and unifying our public square.
Amen. Yeah, we definitely need to heal. Dr. White Bear, how's things looking on campus in regards to this whole issue?
You know, we're pretty still remote, so campus there's not a lot of people on campus, but so it's hard to speak from that angle. What I will say, though, when I was thinking about this question that you just asked, is that the conviction with George Floyd's case to hold his murderer accountable is really what that was, right? It was accountability. I have a hard time calling it justice, because I don't think you can bring justice to that kind of, that level of the treatment of Black and brown men with police violence. It's really hard to have one conviction serve as justice for all that has happened and all the blood that has been shed. And so for me, it's about that accountability. And my hope is that people do not get stuck on that conviction and say, like, we did it, and like, no, we got a lot of work to do. We see it every day. We continue to see violence occurring, and it's because those same systems are in place. Like, those systems have not changed. I've seen some stuff popping up about, like, some reforms to law enforcement and things, but the systems are still there. The ideology is still there, meaning, like, the mindsets of people that look at Black and brown bodies as less than and as disposable. I do a lot of behind the scenes kind of support with murdered and missing Indigenous women's efforts, and just seeing the levels of violence that are placed on Indigenous women and Two-Spirit people and girls, especially in viewing us as disposable, is very, very prevalent. And we have to get past that as society of viewing people as disposable, and as something that can be discarded, and before we can make any progress. So I think that that one conviction can help bring hope and show us what accountability can look like, but we have a lot of work to do. And that's kind of where I'm at with where things are, and thinking about the roles of the protest in helping create awareness. Like, people can't look away now, like, you can't look back. And thinking about some of the statements that have come out of local school districts about, like, Black Lives Matter and about making commitments to anti-racism. I know over here in Corvallis, I'm like, okay, if you say that, like, you can't go back from that. Like, once you say it, we have to keep that work going forward. And it's really important that people are in positions, like we've seen all over the state and country. We've seen a reaction of fear of those kind of statements and policy changes by people trying to undermine them and, like, say things about critical race theory as being, like, harming everybody, when it's really asking us to have conversations. and that's where it starts. If, like, conversations like this, if we can't talk about race and racism, it's not like the issues that are associated with it and the violences are going to go away. They're still there. So we need platforms like this and in the classrooms and within our families, as was expressed, in order to be able to address it. Otherwise, it's going to keep happening.
Absolutely.
Picking up on
Rob, just real quickly, this is not over yet. We still, the convictions of the other police officers who were standing by, they have an obligation here, and they need to be held accountable, and that message needs to go out worldwide, not just in our nation. So I'm really glad to see that still to be developed.
Picking up on Hector's first question and also Dr. White Bear's response, I'm concerned that the momentum of the summer protests may be gone. And in my experience, one of the worst things that you can do is take a look at a need, generate a demand, and then not provide the any kind of sustenance to meet that demand. What happens to keep things going? The momentum of the summer has certainly died down. What can we do to keep it going? It's a raised awareness. It had its flaws, but it had its positive impact. What can we do to keep it going? Has the impact gone away? Rosa, what do you think?
Well, this is a question I appreciate the opportunity to answer. Regardless of how long the protests last or whether or not they cease, we really cannot address injustice and racism without, first of all, understanding exactly what racism is, which it's a system that has structures and policies and practices and norms. And within this structure or this system, folks are assigned values. And this is the system, this structure, and these policies and these practices that have been so historical, that have gone on for more than 400 years. Then racism is the system that determines opportunity based on the color of one's skin, meaning the results or the conditions that fairly advantage whites are the same ones that unfairly disadvantage Blacks and other minorities and indigenous people throughout society. So one of the things we have to deal with, and what brings this to my mind more than anything else, is that there was a conviction of Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd, but that was one conviction. And you mentioned again, Rob, that other trials are coming up because there were other officers involved in that murder. But that one conviction does not deal with the system, the structures, the policies, and the values that give us, and when I say values, I mean the values that are assigned to some people's lives as not being important, and the values that are assigned to the lives of others as being important to society. Unless and until we address that structure and those practices, and again, those policies that create racism, that one conviction is not an accountability for a racist system. It's not, it doesn't account for the long-standing history of injustices. And so we're talking about not just opening up the conversation, but dealing with it forthrightly. And Brother Waji mentioned reparations. Reparations is one thing that can be done in terms of trying to close the gap of the structural system that would allow a law enforcement officer to assume that behavior would once again be acceptable, because it has been acceptable in the past with thousands of other lives. And so it is a structural system that we're going to have to deal with in terms of justice and accountability, or it's going to be very, very difficult to bridge the gap that keeps bringing about the injustice and the inhumanity, there is reason to have hope nonetheless that we can indeed confront racism head on and deal with these issues. One of the things I think about so much, given my background in research in healthcare services, is how the fact that racism in and of itself is a determinant of one's health, whether or not one will receive adequate equality health care. We have to address that, because if there's inequality in health care, that not only harms the people or the individuals that are subjected to this inequality, but it harms the all of America. It harms all of us when we have one segment of our society that is not receiving good health care. And the COVID-19 is a perfect example of how it brought it out into the open, into the forefront, that we had ethnic minorities and racial groups that had underlying health conditions. And so we saw openly the disproportionate impacts of the COVID-19 pandemic. So
we certainly did, Rosa. Rosa, you're answering some of the questions that we're going to ask later. It's a broad topic, and you brought in a lot. We were focusing on the idea of the protests. We'll talk a little bit more about Mr. Floyd's death and the conviction in just a moment. But the point I'm trying to get to, Dr. White Bear, Waji, is we've had riots before. We've had protests. We've had peaceful marches. There's been Watts. I'm old enough to remember that. And of course, we had the summer. And you see, things happen and then they die down. I'm asking whether the excitement and progress and movement, that hope, whether that can be sustained without continual protests. Dr. White Bear?
I think that that the protests that we've seen are an extension, right? Like you said, they've been around for a while. People have been standing up against injustice since contact, right? And it's not like that's new. That's how old these systems are. They are older than the country that we live in since it was formed. There's been people that have always stood up to injustice. So I think a lot of times people will say things like, oh, to justify behaviors of people that displayed racism or misogyny against women or homophobia or transphobia in the past. And we'll use terminology like, oh, they were people of their time. And I have a little bit of an issue with that, because that disregards the people that stood up during those times, that knew that that was wrong. There has always been resistors against injustices. They just get silenced a lot of the time. And I think that the most recent protest and other ones that you mentioned were ones that were more vocal, that are they can't be silenced in the ways that they have in the past. They're too documented, right? There's too many pictures, there's too many live streams, there's videos. Like, these stories won't be silenced. And one of the other things, some of my academic research pieces around like hashtags and social movements and stuff like that, is that the hashtags stay around, but they also fade, but the issue is still there. So how do you keep sustaining hope beyond those moments when the hashtags are trending, right? And a lot of it has to do with that commitment. Like, what are people willing to commit to beyond sharing a hashtag or beyond holding a sign for that day? Like, what are the everyday things people are doing? And so I think that's how hope continues, is that we continue to intervene in the moments that are not out there, like how they have been with the large scale protests and riots. Like, what are people doing when they're interrupting conversations with family members? Those are the hardest. Like, how are people preparing themselves to have those conversations? What kind of education are they doing for themselves? And so there's plenty of opportunities out there for people to start learning more. And there's lots of work to do behind the scenes. So thinking about policies, like people who are responsible for developing policies, how are they interrupting some of these injustices in those ways too? I think once we start working on that, which is happening across the board in multiple different types of policy work, that we'll start to see some shifts, because policies really define a lot of our experiences. And so those are ways that hope can continue beyond the hashtags and beyond the social media streams. Like, what are those moments, those little moments that we can hold on to, and we can create those small pieces of change that connect to the much larger changes that are happening.
Cool. Thank you. Wajid?
I agree with my beloved sisters, you know, in what they have said, but I will also, and for me, is to address, you know, the spiritual, that we need to really cultivate the spiritual rejuvenation, you know, wake up the conscious of humanity, whether people of goodwill or people that have, you know, are affiliated with any spiritual path, they need to wake up, you know. We need to wake up that spiritual conscious mind, you know, that, you know, that will unite us and remember the divine, that in our tradition as Muslims, you know, we say no one shall believe unless they love for their brother what they love for themselves. So, you know, we, in the context of George Floyd, you know, yes, many people marched in the 60s and the 50s and the 70s. Many people sang the song, you know, we shall overcome, you know, one day. I don't want one day, I want today. Today is the key, you know, towards our healing, you know. The injustice in you know, of our humanity is deep rooted in religious context, you know, with Abel and Cain and many other stories that happened, you know, in Asia, in Africa, in Europe, in the indigenous societies. And so the waking up of this spiritual conscious mind is a key factor, you know, that will bring us, you know, towards healing and unifying. Our bigotry and hate will stop now. As far as we are humans, and I did mention last December, you know, the Arabic word for human is insan, I-N-S-A-N, means to forget, that we forget, you know, we forget our, you know, our duties towards ourselves, our family, our community. And this is the challenge today, is how can we address, you know, the conscious mind, you know? We condemned, you know, the previous administration and justice, you know? For me, with all my love to my Democrats, you know, and I voted Democrats since Clinton, you know, it doesn't matter who's in the White House. What matters is what policies they will deliver, you know? For me, we rallied behind our brother, our beloved brother, you know, Barack Obama. But Barack Obama, for me today, as a Yemeni American, you know, he displaced my people inside Yemen. He okayed the war in Yemen. So bigotry and hate need to be addressed to the root causes. The root causes is that conscious mind. We say no, you know, to lobbying organization. We say no to corporate, you know, lobbying. We say no to, you know, to other than our conscious. Our conscious is to heal and unify beyond the color of our skin. You know,
I so much appreciate the addition of the spiritual factor. I'd like to thank you all for your candid and open comments. This has been a fantastic beginning to a great conversation. Please join us next week when we'll continue with part two.
Thank you for listening to Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon. Go to our website, insidewashco.org, to contact us or leave comments on this interview. This series is produced by Mark Berry.
And welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community media. We bring local stories to a national audience produced at a different location every week. Hey, I'm Nick Espinoza of the Deep Dive Radio Show, where we talk about all things cybersecurity, cyber warfare, and technology related, broadcasting out of the Chicagoland area on WHIW 101.3 FM. And we've got a great episode of Sprouts for you. I got to sit down with Jatarth Dadeja, former QAnon adherent, and talk to him the day before the presidential election in 2020. Don't miss this interview. Let's kick it off. I think you're going to enjoy it.
Hey, everybody. Nick Espinoza, your chief security fanatic here. And today I have a very special guest with me, and I think you guys are going to find this interview just to be beyond fascinating. I am here with Jatarth Dadeja, and I know I pronounced that correctly because I did ask you ahead of time on that one. But you are going to find this, I think, really, really interesting. I learned about Jatarth from the Washington Post in an excellent article called "He's a former QAnon believer. He doesn't want to tell his story, but he thinks it might help." And I am very happy, Jatarth, that you want to tell your story. And thank you for joining me today.
No, thank you, Nick. And I'll try to be absolutely fascinating, but I probably won't be.
Just be yourself. That's the only thing I think an interviewer can ever ask for, is just to be yourself.
No worries.
And I want to dive right in, because I'm